and welcome to Dialect from the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and to our listeners on Preston FM on 103.2.
And Radio Verulam in St Albans, and also to our listeners in Swindon on Swindon FM. Coming up in today's programme, more about the Bristol Pound. This is the new currency for Bristol.
Sabine Hassler is here in the studio, and she's from the University of the West of England. She's going to chat about corporate social responsibility. I'll also be chatting to Ben Davies. He's training to be a barrister, and he's here to talk about legal aid and what's happening at the moment.
Tony Gosling visits the Somerset Levels to find out about bird migration.
Malcolm Grieve reads part one of the last chapter of Treasure Island. Jess Sparks is not here in person this week, but he has sent in his What's On guide, so we'll be hearing that later.
We've also got some poetry from Rosemary Dunn, and Tim Burrows will be joining us later with also some poems or a song. I'm Michaela Dennis.
And I'm John Peters Coleman.
I'm joined now by Dr. Sabine Hassler. You're a corporate law lecturer at the University of West England.
Hello.
Hi. And you're here to talk about a new initiative that you've set up called the Business and Society Partnership.
That's right.
And it's going to be kind of looking in a bit more detail at corporate social responsibility.
That's right.
Could you tell us, what is CSR?
That's a very good question. I don't think anybody out there really knows what corporate social responsibility as such is. It is basically all the fuzzy bits around what corporate governance normally deals with, all the legal aspects that companies have to comply with. But this goes more into what companies voluntarily contribute to society. So what are they prepared to support maybe in the community that they're involved in, or generally largely contribute and give back to the society in which they exist.
Do you have some kind of famous examples that might trigger in people's minds?
Almost every company out there has some kind of corporate social responsibility. After the BP oil disaster, for instance, they were backtracking very quickly, trying to say, yes, but we are environmentally friendly and we try to do everything in order to make sure that we do not harm the environment. So there's always some attempt to make sure that they show that the environment is the big theme, but there's also being sure that you don't harm, you know, the supply chain, so you don't employ child labour, for instance, or you don't even support, say, armed conflicts in Sierra Leone by buying conflict diamonds.
Okay, most people would call that PR, wouldn't they?
Probably there's a large part involved in PR, but it also is an incentive for companies to show that they can do good. There is no doubt some of it is PR, but I think a lot of companies are now also realizing that if they want to be what they sometimes call even corporate citizens, that they are citizens and that they give back to society. So show some involvement or some voluntary basis by which they can give back.
So the Google try not to be evil line, I suppose.
That's pretty much it, yes.
Okay. Tell me more about your specific initiative. So it's the Business and Society Partnership.
Yeah.
It's kind of brand new, isn't it?
Very new, yes. Three colleagues of mine, Noel Kennedy, Elena Blanco and Jonah Razak from the same Department of Law in UWE. We all teach sort of in the corporate area, international law and also on the globalization environmental front. So we sort of combine all the interests that flow into corporate social responsibility. And we thought, well, academically, there is masses out there. You can find reams and reams of articles that deal with CSR. But we wanted to find out, what do businesses actually do, you know, in the real world? And then we looked at, how can we find out more? Well, we have to talk to businesses. And then we thought, everything centers in London. There is more outside of London. What about our area? What about Bristol and sort of the wider southwest region? And that's where we started. We started contacting hundreds and hundreds of businesses of any size and asked them whether they would be prepared to talk to us about what they deem to be CSR. And as it turns out, they wanted to. We have now something like 160 businesses signed up, and we had in November last year a first what we called agenda setting meeting, where 50 businesses of every size turned up and actually told us what they thought CSR is and what they want to do with it.
That's a very large response, I suppose. Why do you think people were so interested?
That is a very good question. I think it's because everybody talks about CSR and every company out there almost has to now have some kind of CSR presence. You know, when you go onto websites, there's always some kind of corporate responsibility or corporate social responsibility button. But very few businesses out there actually know what to do with it. How do you do good Is it by giving money? Is it by giving your time? Is it by becoming more involved in what the community does? Is it just by showing that you're environmentally friendly? And I think they wanted also to find out what other businesses are doing, maybe learning by seeing what others do. And so on the 21st of November last year, they came and they chatted and talked and discussed and debated for about 4 hours, talking about these issues that they thought are the most important things about CSR.
Just to put you on the spot, what were the main points that people came out with in that meeting? How did people kind of describe it? How would people want to action this idea of CSR?
Well, we asked them in preparation for this meeting whether they wanted to talk about something specific. So we gave them the 6 most common areas that are raised in CSR. So that was, for instance, the environment, sustainable development, community involvement, bribery, anything like that. And we asked them on the day to discuss these points. And then they suddenly turned around and said, well, actually, we know that we shouldn't be bribing and we know we shouldn't be bribed.
Should be obvious, shouldn't it?
Yeah. We know that we need to be environmentally friendly. We know what sustainable development is all about. What we really want to know is, how are we implementing this? How can we show our values? And so out of this meeting came the idea that they wanted to sit down together and actually discuss leadership in CSR and values in CSR. And that's where we're going next. That's why we're having a round table on the 8th of June with our stakeholders to discuss exactly these points, leadership and values.
Okay. In terms of, can businesses and people be involved in that in the future?
Absolutely, absolutely. On our UE website, we do have a link to the Business and Society Partnership. We have also a LinkedIn group. So anybody who wants to join, very welcome to have a look and contact any of us to talk to us about it.
What are the wider aims for this initiative for you and your team?
Well, we wanted to obviously provide a platform for these businesses to talk, because as academics, there's always the idea that we're sort of sitting on cloud cuckoo land and come up with our own ideas. And what we wanted them to do is inform us what the practical implications of CSR are, but also to give them the opportunity and a forum, basically, to talk to each other. And out of this, we also want to make sure that their ideas are carried further, so it's not just a talk shop and nothing ever happens. We have found interest from local councils, from MPs. In one particular case, we have, hopefully, the interest of a MEP, of a member of the European Parliament, to actually come and listen to what our stakeholders have to say about real issues that they, as businesses, face in implementing CSR.
It's going to be difficult because, as you say, there's such a range of small two-people businesses to large corporations. How are they going to action these really quite general and far-reaching ideas individually for themselves? Surely it's quite bespoke and personal to their business, isn't it?
This is exactly what they want to talk about at that first round table, because there is no template, there is no one-size-fits-all solution. What works for one business may not necessarily work for another, but sometimes it may just be the general idea or the approach that they can share in how they can go forward. So sometimes there may be a particular strategy that one business has employed and the other think, oh, actually, that might be something that we could use. Maybe not exactly along those lines, but as a general approach that might work for another business and they haven't even thought about it before.
It's interesting to me, looking at this kind of initiative in the prism of, you know, the economy and what's going on in terms of people lashing out against capitalism, lots more protest. I mean, how do you think that generally fits in with how businesses are viewing CSR and thinking this is something we should be doing? We need to maybe put profits on one hand, but also be thinking about ourselves, as you say, as a citizen. Mm.
I think there may be some influence that some businesses feel the pressure by the public that they have to show that it's not always about the bottom line, it's not always about making the big profit. And I think sort of consumer interest, consumer pressure does have an impact on how businesses act. I mean, most of us probably, if we have a choice between 2 cubes of sugar, one's got a fair trade logo, the other hasn't, we probably would go for the fair trade logo just because we know, well, theoretically at least, that it was produced under fairer conditions. So I think a lot of businesses are now not backtracking, but they're sort of acknowledging that profits are one thing, but you can make profits and still be good.
Well, let's hope that they can. Thank you, Sabine. And just to give some, just if someone wants to find out about the LinkedIn group and the website, could you read those out?
The LinkedIn group is just known as the Business and Society Partnership on LinkedIn. So we can be contacted through that. And we can be found on the University of the West of England's main website under the Department of Law.
Brilliant. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
It's my pleasure to introduce Ben Davies to the studio. Hello.
Hi there.
So tell us a little bit about yourself and your background in law.
Well, I've been training now for just under 4 years. I did my 3 years LLB undergraduate studies at the University of the West of England.
Okay.
And I'm now in my final phases of training as a barrister.
Okay.
I also work for an environmental pro bono organisation providing free legal advice to community groups.
Okay. How easy have you found that to do, you know, financially and practically, you know, sort of in brief? I'd imagine that involves an awful lot of money.
A lot of debt, a lot of working for free, a lot of supportive partners, supportive parents.
Okay. Do you have to specialise in anything in your degree or in what you're doing now as a barrister?
No, when you do your undergraduate degree, you essentially do the core modules and you take some specialist subjects. In my third year, I did environmental law, and okay. That really started my research interest, and I managed to find something that I felt really happy doing because it was something I could feel good about. It was a good kind of work that I could do.
Yeah, because there is a very wide moral spectrum when it comes to, you know, training to be a lawyer. It could mean anything.
Absolutely. There's a very strict and highly complex code of conduct to which we must all adhere. Things like the cab rank rule, you're not allowed to accept or reject cases based on your personal feelings towards them. So if a case lands on your desk, you have to take it as long as it's properly instructed. But you're allowed to specialise, obviously, pick your area of specialty, and environmental law is something I really feel comfortable litigating.
Good. You've come in here to chat about something which has come up on your radar over the past month or so, let's say, legal aid. Now, why is that suddenly a topic that's of interest?
Yeah, I mean, legal aid has been around now since the late 40s. And essentially, legal aid ensures that everybody is entitled to some kind of legal justice. The budget 10 years ago was £3 billion. It's now dropped to £2 billion. And the Legal Services Commission wants to axe it by another £350 million.
Right.
Now, obviously, this does present problems. You know, we're all in a time of extreme financial hardship. But the problems that axing the legal aid budget presents even further is not something that I personally believe society can sustain.
Okay. Is there, therefore, some kind of a situation in which somebody could receive no legal aid and therefore get no justice?
Well, essentially, the Legal Services Commission, certain branches within the LSC, claim that legal aid is new and was an almost temporary measure after the Second World War.
Okay.
In actual fact, legal aid is ancient, since time immemorial. In medieval times, a serf could approach their knight and settle a dispute that way. If there was a land dispute between two serfs, they could go to their knight or indeed go to their lord.
Okay, so landed people could feel a practical or moral obligation to help fund justice occurring in their community.
Absolutely, and there obviously wouldn't be a charge for that because the landed people were charged with looking after their tenants. Shortly after, over the last 200 years or so, just before the legal aid system was brought in, you could apply for a certificate of poverty from the courts, and maybe slightly politically incorrect now, but you could be dubbed a pauper. If you could obtain the certificate naming you a pauper, then you would be exempt from securities. One of the most prominent cases of modern times is a case called Donoghue and Stevenson, and this case essentially created the idea of tortious negligence as we know it. You wouldn't be able to sue for personal injury or anything like that without Donoghue and Stevenson. Now, the claimant in Donoghue and Stevenson was a pauper, and she wouldn't have been able to bring her claim in the House of Lords were it not for her certificate and her solicitors and barristers working for free.
Interesting. Okay, so what happened in the 40s in terms of legal aid as we know it now?
The government introduced an official legal aid scheme and a proper budget for it. This is all part of the social welfare reforms, such as the NHS and the housing initiatives that were produced. That scheme has been running ever since and is now coming under heavy fire and is also experiencing various operational issues as well. Claims, for example, are being rejected. when a barrister or a solicitor does work under legal aid, they have to satisfy themselves that the claim is worthy of legal aid.
Okay, how do they prioritise this? Because this could be, I don't know, I'm trying to imagine legal aid for anything from, you know, I scalded my hands on a hot cup of coffee in McDonald's to something, you know, really serious, you know, like sort of, I don't know, murder or something. Or
absolutely. This is one of the critical points of the debate. When the legal aid budget was seriously reformed in the late 90s, the contingency fee arrangements were brought in, the no win, no fee. Now, this was done because personal injury claims were removed from legal aid because they were seen as too frivolous. Prior to that, a solicitor would have to be satisfied that public money should be brought in on this. Both solicitors and barristers owed a duty to the Legal Services Commission to be independent in making this decision and to have an overriding duty to justice.
Yeah.
So if they thought that public funds should not be spent on a frivolous claim, then they were not entitled to make an application, and that application would not be approved. The problem that we're experiencing these days, as Stephen Cobb QC, who's the chairman of the Family Law Bar Association, has specifically said that there is a high degree of pettiness with the kinds of claims that are being denied. Instances of stamps falling off the edge of a page, resulting in an entire claim being denied several times, costing the claimant upwards of £4,000. This isn't a good example of mal.
Is this purely because they're trying to find a way to not have to spend money?
The LSC adamantly deny that, and they say that these are just operational issues. But there are also a wing of legal practitioners who do believe that there is something more sinister going on, that the government is trying to get rid of legal aid in its entirety.
Okay. Are they sort of doing this in a selective way in terms of the amount of extra cost they think this is going to incur, irrespective of the actual nature of the case? Is that what you're saying?
With regards to the no-win, no-fee or the...
With regards to the way that claims are being rejected in the petty way, do you think that they're sort of trying to judge which ones might be costly and then just say no and find a way of saying no?
The problem is there aren't that many available statistics on that particular point. Largely, the reason the claims are rejected are for grounds of bureaucracy, essentially. Yeah. As I say, stamps being in the wrong place, page numbers being in the wrong place, stuff that doesn't necessarily matter.
Now, if all these people are sort of legal eagles, I mean, harking back to the notion of, you know, who watched the watcher, how do we investigate something like that? You know, if there is sort of potential malpractice occurring, who goes to these people?
Absolutely. Well, the Legal Services Commission have an investigatory panel, and they also have officers attached to the top legal aid firms and the top legal aid chambers as well. And these people work with the practitioners. So if the practitioners have an issue, they can bring this issue to the attention of the officers. The officers obviously then investigate internally. What actually happens then is a matter of some dispute at the moment. As I say, the operational problems that's being experienced by the legal aid are fairly numerous. We have rejections of claims. We also have late payments of claims. So Barristers were running 14 days in arrears, which is, you know, one can live with that, getting paid for work 14 days in arrears.
Well, so what do you think people could do about this, if anything, apart from, you know, observe how the situation deteriorates?
Well, this is something that people need to be vocal about. You know, you need to decide if you want a privatised legal system that prioritises justice for the rich, or if you want a proper legal system, the likes of which the UK has enjoyed for hundreds and hundreds of years, whereby we see everybody being entitled to an adequate measure of justice. People need to make government aware and their local political figures aware that they want legal aid to endure.
Okay, and what's the best way to do that? Write to your local MP, something like that?
Absolutely, write to your local MPs. Keep an eye on this when it comes time for the elections. Look at manifestos and see what a particular party's stance is with regards to legal aid. Essentially, my personal belief is that the most important part of any civilization is a strong legal system, a strong, uncorrupt legal system. And the second you start having premier justice for the rich is when things start to become very, very corrupt very, very quickly. I was actually in court a couple of months ago, And there was a young lad there who had been in the wrong place at the wrong time, certainly couldn't afford the best representation available. But owing to the nature of his claim, and the nature of his defence rather, he was appointed a very senior barrister, and the judge had enormous respect as this barrister came into court. He had enormous respect for him, and the judge said to this defendant, "Now, you're very lucky, young man, to be having this gentleman represent you. Very lucky indeed." And that really is the perfect example of the legal aid system at its best. This young chap was able to have exactly the right person representing him because we have legal aid.
Well, Ben Davies, thank you very much for discussing this. And this looks like something that we might have to come back to in the coming weeks and months as time goes on to see how this develops.
Absolutely. Be happy to oblige.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our two roving reporters, Andrew Dent and Anthea Page, were out and about in the streets of Bristol. They wanted to find out what local people thought of the introduction of the Bristol Pound, a new currency soon to be launched here in Bristol.
I'm Jane Salvage and I run the Bristol Ferry Boat Company. We run ferry services which take people around the harbour if you want to get from A to B or you want to have a circular tour and to have a nice view of all the sites. And we also do a lot of trips, charter trips that enable people to enjoy the harbour in some form, whether educational or just for fun.
Now, the Bristol Pound is a new concept. Why has the Bristol Ferry Boat Company taken it on board?
We were basically contacted by Kieran Mundy and he explained what they were trying to do in Bristol. We are ourselves very much an independent company, a small company here in Bristol, and we deal with a lot of other small companies, suppliers that provide materials for the boats. We do catering for our trips, all sorts of tiny little things, printing, whatever it is. And it sort of sat well with us because we're a small company, and he explained all the other companies that might get involved in the city, and we thought it was a good idea to get on board, and he really wanted us to be a bit of a guinea pig to try it out. And we've got the little phone ready to pass text money from bank to bank and all that sort of thing, and we're standing by and waiting for the go-ahead.
So what would you want to know about the pound?
Well, first of all, will the banks accept them? Because it's no good me having loads of Bristol pounds in my till if I can't put them in the bank. I can see the point that they're trying to make to encourage people to shop in sort of small independents and keep it local. But I've still got quite a few, you know, reservations about it at the moment.
What do I think about the Bristol Pound? I think it's a good idea. It's a way to keep money in the local economy, essentially. Like 5% of what's done in Bristol stay in Bristol.
Would you use it?
Yeah, I'd use the Bristol Pound.
A good idea. Yeah, it could work. Keeps the money in the community, doesn't it? Makes everybody stronger. I don't know that much about it, really. But yeah, it could work. Definitely. I don't know, I'm not sure about buying houses with Bristol Pounds. But yeah, smaller things might work.
Bristol Pound, I think, is a wonderful idea. I think we need to keep our funds as closely to Bristol as possible, so we can make our... I'm actually thinking we should have an Eastern Pound, you know, keep everything in Eastern if we can. You know, we've got such a lovely area here. But that's a funny side. But I think Bristol Pound is a very good idea, and whoever thought of it needs an award as soon as possible.
Would you use it if you knew more and you thought it was a good idea?
Yeah, of course, if you thought it was a good idea. I know they did it at Totnes, didn't they? And, you know, kind of is quite a nice community thing to do, I guess, and kind of makes you proud of your town, I guess.
I think it's a wonderful idea to have a local pound which is spent in Bristol, and I think Bristol is known all over UK. We can keep the money locally. So thank you for bringing up the idea.
Thank you very much to Andrew Dent and Anthony Page and all the various people in the streets, and we'll be hearing more about the Bristol Pound in future shows.
Just northwest of Glastonbury is the centre of the Somerset Levels, and here lies one of the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds' most recent reserves. Ham Wall was set up primarily in an old peat bog, working as a habitat for the rare bittern. But in many ways, the most spectacular bird phenomenon there has become the largest concentration of starlings in the UK, as hundreds of thousands, even millions of starlings gather from all over the levels at dusk to roost. They form a great cloud in the air known as a murmuration. New word for you all there. Dialect's Tony Gosling went down to the rainy Ham Wall last week to witness the biggest murmuration in the country.
My name's Chris Griffin. I'm the RSPB information assistant for Ham Wall and the Avalon Marshes. So I work for the RSPB, and I've been doing this for, this is my second year now. The best thing about the starling roost is that you never see the same thing twice. And just when you think that you're getting to the stage of, oh, just go and see the starlings, they pull out a display that makes you go, God, yeah, actually, they're pretty good, aren't they? They are always really, really inspiring. Hopefully, with the weather tonight, they should still be all right. Generally, when it's a little bit rainy like this, they tend to sort of come in low and go straight into the reeds. Sometimes they don't do the patterns in this kind of weather either, because essentially the reason that they do the patterns is because of a predator response. That's the main reason. So we think we've got around about 3.5 million starlings here at the moment. We've got lots of predators that like eating starlings, especially down here. So things like merlin, peregrine, sparrowhawk, kestrel will have a go, hen harrier, marsh harrier, short-eared owl, barn owl, great white egret, bittern, you know, just to name a few. The reason that they do these patterns, if you've got, say, a flock of 10,000 flying quite slowly, predator, whichever it is, can focus on one individual bird and then go straight for it. But as soon as they start going all over the place, it creates an amazing amount of confusion, and the predator can't focus on one individual bird.
thinks, forget it, this is too hard, I'm going for a duct. You know, it's a lot, it makes a lot more sense. And also the patterns are created essentially by this kind of territorial infighting with the starlings. All the starlings in the flock are trying to get to the safest point. So they're always trying to get on the like the middle of the flock, the inside of the flock. So that's why you've got all this enveloping and all this twisting and turning. Each bird on the outside is trying to get into the middle of the flock. These guys have been a bit infuriating this year. They've moved from here to Shapwick, to Catcott, to West Hay, to here, to everywhere else, about 25 times in the last 2 months. But the reason for that is because it's so mild. In the milder weather, they don't mind expending a bit more energy to go and find a different roost. And the reason they need to find a different roost is, if you imagine, as I said before, 3.5 million starlings. That's 75 grams for each starling. Each starling weighs 75 grams. So you're talking about the equivalent weight of 3 Volvo estates going into the reed bed. That's going to crush the reeds. So that's essentially why they keep moving around. Last year we were very, very lucky. I mean, they stayed in one place, which was the reed bed just behind you, actually. They stayed there for 3.5 months. Didn't move. That was because it was minus 14 every night and they didn't want to expend that energy. They wanted to keep as much energy as they possibly could to keep warm overnight, so they didn't want to move around to find a new roost. They stayed in the same spot. And also, with it being so mild, we've actually seen a reduction of starlings, the number of starlings, more coming behind you now, we've seen a reduction in the number of starlings from last year. We're down about 50%. I think we had about 7 million starlings last year. And the reason is, again, because it's been so mild, a lot of these birds haven't come across from Scandinavia and Russia. They've kind of stayed put. I think they're probably regretting it now, with it being about minus 30 over there, you know. But yeah, a lot of those have stayed put, so we've got a smaller number in Britain. But it does kind of highlight one of the big problems with our starlings. Starlings have been in decline for quite a considerable while now, about 40 years, and it's been a huge decline, 70% in the last 40 years, absolutely astonishing. And you can see that in kind of historical evidence. I mean, if you think in the 50s, 60s, in places like London, Manchester, Birmingham, all these city centres, you used to get flocks of 10, 15 million, you know, amazing flocks. But now, at the moment, we are the biggest flock in the country, 3.5 million, that's how many there are, so a really steep decline. And there's several reasons, ranging from the intensification of agriculture in the sort of 40s, 50s, and use of kind of things like DDT on the land. We've put pay to a lot of our insects. And then, of course, there's an amazing amount of pressure on green space. So these guys find it difficult to find natural nesting holes. So in turn, they kind of got used to us and came and nested under our eaves. But now we've all decided to go green and block up our eaves to save energy. From an RSPB standpoint, any way that you can save energy, you know, blocking up your eaves, that kind of thing, is brilliant, and it is absolutely fantastic. But it's just amazing how something like that can be detrimental to wildlife as well, you know. So yeah, there has been an ongoing decline for a while, but we do try and do as much as we possibly can. I mean, we go out and give consultations to farmers about how to make their lands more suitable to wildlife, how they can get things like environmental stewardship as well. And we also encourage you guys, put some seed out in your back garden for the starlings. Well, I think a lot of people don't like starlings in the back garden because they're a little bit boisterous, kind of kick everything off the bird table, eat all the food. But I always tend to stand up for those guys. Starlings actually are a real benefit for your garden, because they're one of their favourite foods is leather jacket grubs. So if you want your lawn to be lush and green for the next season, get starlings in. And they do wonders, natural fertiliser as well. We are trying to sort of help out and stop the rot of these guys, and things like house sparrow, they've had another decline. And it's the creation of habitats like this that have been kind of key for it, really. For those of you who don't know much about Hamwall, it's a relatively new reserve. It's around about 11 years old. Starling's going overhead, going around the corner there at the moment. And before it was actually a reserve, before it was a reed bed, it was the gravel pits left after all the peat extraction. It was pretty much dead land. And we bought it to make an inland reed bird because they are amazingly important resources. They really, really are. And it wasn't actually for the starlings that we built it for. They're a lovely byproduct of the work that's gone on down here. It was for another bird that we have on the reserve now, the bittern. Now, bitterns, they are an extremely rare bird. Very, very rare indeed. In fact, at their rarest point in the kind of 70s, we were down to 7 booming males in the whole country. 7 booming males, so a very, very small population. Since then, their population has increased to just under 100 booming males. And the best place that we actually have for bitterns is Minsmere, which is over in Suffolk. And they have pretty much 50% of the entire country's population of booming males. The starling roost,
3.5 million-ish.
I mean, obviously, that's an estimate. It's very difficult to actually pin a definite distance. We tend to say sort of 25 miles as a radius. I mean, that could be covering 200 square miles. So, you know, there's still an awful lot of area. Over the back of where the starlings are, that's another great white egret coming across now. So just the left of the tor, just coming behind the trees now, you can just see it just dropping in that big gap, just still and dropping down into the reeds. There he is. Although you might not necessarily know your bird calls and you don't know which species are which, because you've been wandering around your woodlands or, you know, walking around your local reserves, you're automatically aware of what bird songs should naturally be there. So if you do hear something that you've never heard before, or you think, oh, that's weird, keep your eyes open. Ah, this is a bit better. It's nice that we're actually in a bunker at the moment.
That's amazing.
The fastest animal in the world, of course, is the peregrine falcon. Now that rocks. It's my favourite bird. It's kind of like your typical blokish bird, I'm afraid. Fast, deadly, good-looking. Kind of ticks all the boxes.
We like that. Chris Griffin there, who is the RSPB Information Assistant for Ham Wall and the Somerset Marshes. If you want to see the starling murmuration before they set off for Northern Europe, you better be quick, as they head off in the first weeks of March. Crikey, you better be quick. But do bear in mind that you may be disappointed. Last Sunday, about 100 cards and 250 people turned up to Ham Wall, just northwest of Glastonbury, to wait at dusk, but not one single starling appeared. Maybe Somerset will see a new sport of starling chasers developing. Twitches kitted out with 4x4s and two-way radios, rather like the tornado chasers in the US. Maybe indeed. Thanks for that, Tony.
Time now for some Treasure Island. It was written by Robert Louis Stevenson a very long time ago, and it was first published in Young Folks magazine back in the 1880s. We're going to hear the first part of the last chapter.
Can I just confirm it is the last chapter, John?
Yes, this has been going on for quite a long time now, but I understand this is the first part of the last chapter, so this is the penultimate ever instalment.
Great.
Read wonderfully, as usual, by Malcolm Grieve.
Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Part 6, Captain Silver. Chapter 34, and last. The next morning we fell early to work, for the transportation of this great mass of gold near a mile by land to the beach, and thence 3 miles by boat to the Hispaniola, was a considerable task for so small a number of workmen. The three fellows still abroad upon the island did not greatly trouble us. A single sentry on the shoulder of the hill was sufficient to ensure us against any sudden onslaught, and we thought, besides, that they had had more than enough of fighting. Therefore the work was pushed on briskly. Grey and Ben Gunn came and went with the boat, while the rest, during their absences, piled treasure on the beach. 2 of the bars slung in a rope's end made a good load for a grown man, one that he was glad to walk slowly with. For my part, as I was not much use at the carrying, I was kept busy in the cave all day, packing the minted money into bread bags. It was a strange collection, like Billy Bones's hoard for the diversity of coinage, but so much larger and so much more varied that I think I never had more pleasure than in sorting them. English, French, Spanish, Portuguese, Georges and Louis, doubloons and double guineas, and moidores and sequins. The pictures of all the kings of Europe for the last 100 years. Strange oriental pieces, stamped with what looked like wisps of string or bits of spider's web. Round pieces and square pieces. And pieces bored through the middle, as if to wear them round your neck. Nearly every variety of money in the world must, I think, have found a place in that collection. And for number, I'm sure they were like autumn leaves, so that my back ached with stooping, and my fingers with sorting them out. Day after day this work went on. By every evening a fortune had been stowed aboard, but there was another fortune waiting for the morrow. And all this time we heard nothing of the three surviving mutineers. At last, I think it was on the third night, the doctor and I were strolling on the shoulder of the hill where it overlooks the lowlands of the isle, when, from out of the thick darkness below, the wind brought us a noise between shrieking and singing. It was only a snatch that reached our ears, followed by the former silence. "Heaven forgive them," said the doctor. "'Tis the mutineers." "All drunk, sir," struck in the voice of Silver from behind us. Silver, I should say, was allowed his entire liberty, and in spite of daily rebuffs, seemed to regard himself once more as quite a privileged and friendly dependent. Indeed, it was remarkable how well he bore these slights, and with what unwearying politeness he kept on trying to ingratiate himself with all. Yet I think none treated him better than a dog, unless it was Ben Gunn, who was still terribly afraid of his old quartermaster, or myself, who really had something to thank him for. Although for that matter, I suppose, I had reason to think even worse of him than anybody else, for I had seen him meditating a fresh treachery upon the plateau. Accordingly, it was pretty gruffly that the doctor answered him. "Drunk or raving?" said he.
"Right you were, sir," replied Silver. "And precious little odds which, to you or me."
"I suppose you would hardly ask me to call you a humane man," returned the doctor with a sneer. "And so my feelings may surprise you, Master Silver. But if I were sure they were raving, as I am morally certain one at least of them is down with fever, I should leave this camp, and at whatever risk to my own carcass, take them the assistance of my skill."
"Ask your pardon, sir. You would be very wrong," quoth Silver. "You would lose your precious life, and you may lay to that. I'm on your side now, hand and glove, and I shouldn't wish for to see the party weakened, let alone yourself, seeing as I know what I owes you. But these men down there, they couldn't keep their word. No, not supposing they wished to. And what's more, they couldn't believe as you could."
"No," said the doctor. "You're the man to keep your word. We know that."
Thank you very much to Malcolm Grieve and also to Robert Louis Stevenson for writing the book, I suppose. And that was part one of chapter 34 of Treasure Island. And the final ever instalment will be next week. Hey, it's a pleasure to introduce Rosemary Dunn to the studio.
Hello there.
What do you have for us this week?
Okay, well, actually, I wrote a poem about the Bristol Pound.
Ah, very topical. Excellent.
Yes, which I did in one day because I only knew that that was going to be the topic tonight. So I apologise, is all I can say. So here we are then, the Bristol Pound. I promise to pay the bearer the equivalent of a pound. I promise to pay the bearer a part of Bristol town where we got trip hop, drum and bass, dubstep, hippie rave on. We're a city and a county. We never did like Avon. We got babbers and dappers. The downs are girt lush. Over in Sneed Park, it's all millionaires and dead posh. Bristol promises the bearer an extra L on Sarah. Cyril, see? If you've not already heard, we add an L on the end of words. Bristol Cities is the name for ladies' baps. Though we're the home of Plimsoll, gym shoes are called daps. With a home of Cary Grant, a popular film location, we introduced Eddie Shoestring and Casualty to the nation. We got Tricky, we got Banksy, our rivers cleaner than the Yangtze. We gave the world pirates, Bluebeard, smugglers and the rest with a gateway to the picturesque mild, mild west. It's true we are marred, our past scarred by slavery. Now we're far more multicultural, enjoy a rich black history. Though Bristol city centre was blown to bits in Second World War Luftwaffe bombing blitz, we survived, though nearly ruined by Bristol town planning, who displayed as much finesse as a concrete-loving Bernard Manning. Still, we have Quakers and Bakers, Pie Minster, Fries and Cadbury, tobacco, air balloons and the Beeb's natural history. It's a mystery, don't you think? Why Bristol doesn't shout of its richness and its coolness, of just what it's all about? So in keeping with our innovation, our vibrancy all round, it's a pleasure to introduce the new Bristol Pound, coming soon to a Bristol near you.
Well, thank you very much, Rosemary Dunn.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're joined by Tim Burrows and Chris Hales. You guys are here with a song for us today.
That's right, yeah.
So I believe. Tell me, what have you got? What's it about?
It's called For a Dollar a Day. It's about low-paid work in Southeast Asia. Like, there's been all the stuff about Apple, and they're now doing surveys to make sure their suppliers keep their workers in decent conditions. And I wrote this some time back, but obviously the issue's still rolling, so...
Cool. Let's hear it.
Leash your soul as cheap butts, the glasses for short sight. Long hours and burnt fingers, she never sees daylight. She's working for the dollar now, multinational way. She's living in the shadowland, just a dollar a day. Kids at home to feed, parents outside Beijing. A landlord charges too much rent for shack over sewage pond. She's working for the dollar now, multinational way. Living in the shadowland, just a dollar a day. Lee looks twice her age, eyesight fading in bad light. Fingers burnt from working chips, day right through the night. She's working for the dollar now, multinational way. Living in the shadowland, just a dollar a day. Soon she'll be made redundant, her eyesight will be too bad, but she'll have got her kids through school, treated her parents right. She's working for the dollar now, multinational way. Living in the shadowland, just a dollar a day. Working for the dollar now, multinational way. She's living in the shadowland, just a dollar a day.
Many thanks for that, guys, do you have any up-and-coming gigs, things that you'd like people to know about?
On Sunday week, we're playing at the Barrel Inn in Thornbury from about... There's two or three acts from about 8 till 11, so that's Sunday week.
And where's that again, sorry?
The Barrel Inn in Thornbury.
Great. No Jeff this week. He's out and about in London. He's written us a What's On guide, and Addie Eliason is very kindly going to read it for us. So over to you, Addie.
Thank you. Hello, this is your What's On guide from Dialot. Starting with Friday, 9th March, Slim Chance, the band Rony Lane formed when he left the Faces, will be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £12 in advance. Doors open at 7pm. Also on 9th March, Teeth of the Sea will be performing with support from Mugstar and Rapid Pigs at the Continental in South Meadow Lane, Preston. Tickets are £5.50 in advance and £7 on the door, and doors open at 8pm. On to Song of the Week, and I present Show of Hands. They are classed as one of the big three of folk music, the other two being Seth Lakeman and Bellowhead, and Elle from Exeter, Devon. This is from the compilation album Roots, The Best Of, and it's the song titled Are We All Right?
You don't need to cry, you don't need to shout, paint on the front door or ride on the clouds. I had a moment's fear, you can put a flight. Just reassure me that we're alright. Are we alright? Are we still strong? We got one last chance. Don't get it wrong. Some dignity, and I'll stay cool and calm tonight. I need to know if we are still alright. Oh, it won't take much to turn black to white. One gentle touch.
Show of Hands with Are We Alright from album Roots, The Best Of, which was released in 2007. For more information, you can check out www.showofhands.co.uk. Into Saturday 10th March, Anti-Norway League will be performing with support from Rash Decision at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7pm. Also on 10th March, Stash Tin Promotions in conjunction with the Sunday Rock Show on BCFM presents Cada Performance Alien Stash Tin and 647 at the Springs Garden in Otwells Road, Otwells, Bristol. Entry is free and doors open at 8 p.m. Finally, on Sunday 11th March, Emily Autumn will be performing at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7 p.m. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Addy, and we hope to have Jeff back next week.
Well, that's all from Dialect for this week. The studio guest we had was Sabine Hassler, and we also had Ben Davies chatting about legal aid.
The features were by Tony Gosling and also Anthea Page and Andrew Dent. We had Malcolm Grieve reading another instalment of Treasure Island, the final chapter now.
Indeed, that is the case, yes, and the final instalment will be next week. We also had Rosemary Dunn and Tim Burrows providing some poetry and entertainment. And the studio engineer was Michael Lewis, and the producer was Anthea Page. Goodbye from myself, John Peters Coleman.
And myself, Michaela Dennis.
Take care and have a good week. Thank you for listening.
Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale, you grey haired manky codger. Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale, you grey haired manky codger. Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale, you grey haired manky codger. Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale. Not for sale. So the budget of the PCTs, he wants a hand to the GPs, oh please. Don geeks are gonna buy from any willing provider and get care from private companies. So the pie and the one a piece, got the rise on the peas like mice for the cheese. Talk truth when I write the beat, you talk shite when you speak. See money when you close your eyes to sleep. So fall back, your face looks like a shriveled up bull sack. The stuff that you say is bullcrap. I'm sure Andy Pandy snorts crack. Health minister, I mean sinister. You know the public will finish ya. Is your brain really that miniature? You full of crap, give yourself an enema. You're filthy rich from those who represent Walker's Chris. Mars and pizza hot proved you're a health slot. And you're always talking strict. £134 an hour, every week that's quite a lot of quids. And you came to the conclusion the food industry should be a little less strict. Scandal disclosed that you flip your second home. You said your claims were within the rules. Filled your pockets, took us for jokes. How would you cope when broke folk get ill, injured and broke, but they don't have the dough to get their life back on the road, so the poor die slow and the rich take control. Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale, you grey-haired manky codger. Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale, you grey-haired manky codger. Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale, you grey-haired manky codger. Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale. Not for sale. Lansley's white paper liberating the NHS sets out a plan where we'll become more like the US, and care will be farmed out to private companies who will sell their service to the NHS via GPs, who will have more to do with their service purchase arrangements than anything to do with even seeing their patients. He's been given cash by Johnny Nash, chairman of Care UK, a private healthcare provider who, if they have their own way, will be the biggest beneficiaries of Conservative Lib Dem policies to privatise healthcare, pull apart their welfare state. These plans have been slacked by patient organisations, charities, unions, nursing and medical institutions. The Royal College of GPs even joined the attack. Looked closely at the proposals and said they were crap. So say yes for the NHS. Andrew Lansley could suck at David Cameron's breast. He's questing for the rich to pay less and the poor have to stress. It'll be one big mess. Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale, you grey-haired manky codger. Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale, you grey-haired manky codger. Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale, you grey-haired manky codger. Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale, not for sale.
cause we're gone by and by just to wreck your feet. You'll look neat on the sunny side of the street. Can't you hear the bitter and the batter of the raindrops trickling down your fire escape ladder? Life can be so fine. Walk in the shade with my blues on parade. Well, I'm not afraid, cause my rovers, they're over, passed over. If I never have a cent, I'll be rich as Rockefeller with gold dust at my feet on the sunny, yes, on